Thank you.
This conference call is now being recorded. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to the locking of a domain name subject to UDRP proceedings call on Thursday, 31st of January. On the call today, we have Hago Dafala, Christine Derain, Lisa Gaono, Alan Greenberg, Volker Grayman, Celia Lerman, David Maher, Luke Surfer, Matt Schneller, Faisal Cha, Gabrielle the Slack. We have apologies from Michaeli Nealon and Laurie Anderson. And from staff, we have Marika Connings, Barry Cobb, and myself, Julia Chauvelin. May I remind all participants to please state their names before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much, and over to you.
Thank you very much. Marika, I believe you wanted to talk about work plan. Oh, well, first of all, does anyone have any changes in statement of interest? Hearing no shouts, seeing no hands, we will go on to the item number two, of review of the work of the update plan. As a prelude to it, Marika noticed that we didn't make our deadline of having a report for the end of December, for December. Some of the rest of you may have noticed also, and has some proposals to make. Marika, can you go ahead?
Yes, this is Marika. We initially set ourselves a deadline, indeed, for the end of last year to publish our initial report, but you know, for very good reasons, we didn't make that deadline because we did receive a lot of input that the working group was reviewing, but I think we're making really good progress now on you know, getting, we've gone through all the comments and are now working our way through the draft recommendation. So a proposal would be to actually try to get the initial report ready by the publication date for the Beijing meeting, because that would give us an opportunity as well to actually present the report during that meeting and discuss it with participants of the meeting and explain, you know, why we've come up with these recommendations and already encourage them to participate in the public comment forum, which we can then have open in parallel. So that would mean actually that we would need to get everything ready at the latest by the 15th of March, which I think should give us sufficient time to work through the recommendations. I think we still have quite a few comments in there, and I think we're still working on some issues. In parallel, I've already started working on a first draft of the initial report, which I think I should be able to share with you probably before the next meeting, the beginning of next week. Basically, just outline some of the background to this issue, some of the administrative details, and I've tried to go through the different discussions that we've had in relation to the charter questions. Of course, one part that will go in there eventually are the recommendations, but in order to, you know, win some time, I think it would be helpful if people already can start reviewing the information that is in there, so we, in parallel, can hopefully finalize the recommendations, which then would go into the report, so we can hopefully have everything ready by the 15th of March. So that would be my suggestion or proposal to the group.
Thank you, Marika. I strongly support it. There's nothing like a deadline to get us to get something out. And I think it almost doesn't matter at this point how much is firm recommendations and how much is identifying issues that we want further input on, or simply serving notice that we are still considering options on sections. I think if we don't meet this meeting, we're going pretty far without without either coming to some semi-conclusions or getting more input. So I think it's timely. I would suggest that we not do the public comment in parallel, however, unless we do a really elongated one. I think we should allow a reasonable amount of time after the meeting. And, you know, given where this meeting is, there's an awful lot of travel involved and a lot of people also taking vacations, for a week or so afterwards, or certainly days. So I think we want to make sure we don't cut short the comment period, but we can debate that when we're coming closer to the actual deadline. So I strongly support getting something out, and I'm not particularly agonizing over how complete it is, because I think regardless it'll be a good opportunity to get more input. Any other thoughts on that? The general agreement, or do people want to alter that? I see we've lost David.
What was our target date again?
Pardon me?
What was our target date again?
The target date is we would have to have the report published by, which means the draft done and all of our comments on it by the middle of March. Because there's a roughly a two-week deadline before the beginning of an ICANN meeting for publication if we plan to discuss it. And I think our intent would be to schedule a session. Marika, I presume sometime soon we're going to be asked if we want a session or not. So maybe we should try to discuss that today also.
Yeah, this is Marika. I'm suspecting indeed that we'll need to fill in the request forms. I think someone mentioned that it may be coming in next week. But I think what we can do if you know, we basically request a meeting time and a date, and we can always cancel if we don't need it. But I think it's as we're working towards that deadline, I think it's probably prudent to just request a time and see when we get close to the date.
Yeah, probably polite if we let Michele know we're doing this. But other than that, I can't see a reason not to request an open meeting. Okay, no comments on the proposed agenda, so Marika, you'll do your magic and with the new target end date, work backwards and give us a work plan. And I look forward to seeing the first draft. Any other administrative stuff before we go back into the substance of our issues? Hearing nothing, seeing nothing. I'll let Marika tell us where we are, because I've lost track.
Yeah, this is Marika. We still have two documents, because there are still some comments that we didn't address that I think came in some time ago from ICANN staff, but it may make sense to actually first continue with the straw man and basically pick up, I think, where we left off last time, as there were some, there has been some suggested language inserted here that was being proposed by Christine and Volker made some comments as well on that. So maybe it makes sense to start with that, which is in draft recommendation 3, basically the language that's highlighted in red.
Okay, and I have a question on draft on 3 also. If I understand what this is saying correctly, the current definition we may be using for pendency is as soon as the complaint is filed.
Right, and just Marika, to clarify, this was the language that was suggested, I think, by David from WIPO,
yeah,
which was circulated to the list, and we've inserted it here, but we haven't really discussed that in further detail yet.
Okay, yeah, my question was, how can we have a rule saying a registrar is not allowed to make a change from a time which is before they know of the existence of the dispute? I think this is saying there is while it is pending, they cannot make those changes, but they don't know about it until a later date. And that's what the stuff in red says, I think. So I think we need to be careful there that we're not putting rules in which are impossible to follow. Anyone? Am I still on the call?
You still are?
Yes, you are.
Okay. I have this feeling of talking into an abyss. All right. Are there any other comments on this proposed language? As I said, that seemed to me as an inconsistency which we have to fix. Unless I'm misreading it.
This is Marika. You're now talking about the dependency suggestion or the whole section in red? Because there is a comment in there, I think, from Volker, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, I was talking about the beginning, where it says a registrar may not permit transfer to another registrant or registrar after receipt. Hold it, maybe. I thought I saw a word somewhere that said they can't do it while it's pending. Maybe I was looking at old words. Okay, Marika, I think I'm confused because I was trying to catch up and
I don't know what I was looking at when I wrote
this comment earlier this morning.
Alan, are you talking about below, right at the bottom of that page? It says any changes to WHOIS information during the pendency of the administrative proceeding. We talked about, we've talked about pendency and WHOIS changes. Is that what you were maybe thinking of?
Yes, I think so.
The bottom of that page.
You know, that's the changes that the registrant must inform the provider. Okay,
I understand you correctly, that you're basically saying, like, how can a registrar prevent any changes if it doesn't even know that a complaint has been filed, because it will only get notified at the moment of verification.
Yes, that's what I thought I read somewhere, right. But now I can't see those words, so I may have misread something.
I think it's there in the beginning, because it basically says the registrar will prevent any changes of registrar and registrant, and then it says these changes should be prevented for during the whole pendency of the EDR.
You got it. That's right. The combination of words that I was looking at. So it looks like we have a conflict between these terms, between these different sections. Just later on, the new wording in red says may not permit it after they've received the request for verification.
And where's the conflict? I'm sorry, I missed it.
At the beginning of Draft 3, the registrar will prevent any changes. These changes should be prevented during the whole pendency period. And the pendency period, I thought we are defining as from the time the complaint is filed.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah, pendency is defined from the moment it's been filed.
Right.
However, the registrar theoretically doesn't necessarily know of the case the moment it's been filed.
Correct.
Okay. Okay, yeah. So I think, yeah, so just a clarification there, I think. So it has to be from the whole meeting except we have to define the commencement of it. Not the commencement, because that's an official UDRP term.
We can't say the registrar must do it during the whole pendency, and at the same time say they don't have to do it until they're notified.
Correct. Yeah, that's that makes sense. Okay.
Okay. Sorry,
okay,
I wasn't imagining it completely. It just took me a while to remember where it was or be pointed where it was. Thank you.
So
okay,
the problem here, maybe,
then.
Can I ask if I understand this? So you're saying that there's a period in which the registrar might be mandated to do something which they still don't know. That's the problem, right?
That's the problem with this draft wording that we have, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Marika, back to you.
Yeah, this is Marika. I think actually Matt has suggested some good language in the chat, because he's suggesting that it should be these changes must be prevented from receipt of a request for verification for the remaining pendency, which I think clarifies that. Because I think there is still, if I understood previous discussions well, there's still a need to clarify what pendency means to really make sure that registrars understand that they have this requirement from the moment of indeed verification and not necessarily from the moment of official commencement, because I think there was some confusion over that. So I think we may still want to keep the definition in, but indeed make clear that the requirement for registrars is only from the moment of verification and then for the rest of the duration of the UDRP proceeding.
Indeed, and you know, in the other document you distributed, you pointed out that I think it was compliance that identified several uses of the word pendency, not all of which mean the same thing. Because here we're talking about pendency of the UDRP, but there's also other things that may affect it, court cases and such. Okay, back to you.
This is Marika. I think maybe it's better to have Christine talk about the next section, which C has suggested, and then have Volker talk about his comments to this, I would propose.
Okay.
Okay, that would require me reading it. Now, we're talking about the next piece read right before draft recommendation 4?
Correct.
Okay.
I think so.
So this is the part where we're talking about underlying, revealing the underlying data. And then a registrar may opt to reveal underlying data in a privacy proxy relationship to the provider or in who is or both. If it is aware of such, this will not count as a transfer in violation of the above if it occurs prior to the lock and the registrar's reply to the provider. And then it looks like there's a comment about if a privacy proxy relationship is released after the lock is applied and the provider is notified, the provider is under no obligation to require the complainant to amend its complaint accordingly, but may do so in its discretion. It is the responsibility of the registrant, citing UDRP Rule 2E and UDRP Rule 5B2, to inform the provider of any relevant updates that may affect provider notices and the respondent under the UDRP, and the provider shall, in accordance with the UDRP, provide respondent with case information at the details it prefers once the provider is aware of the update. And then UDRP 5B3 requires the provider to send communications to the preferred email address of the respondent, for instance. And then, so that's my suggestion is how to deal with the privacy proxy. And then it looks like Volker's suggestions were related to, oh, I see. Yes, Volker's comment, and I saw this email come through. He had a problem with it being optional for the provider for the reason of the effects detailed above that a non-amendment may have. And the problem with this is that, I mean, and Volker's, I think he's on, and I would welcome the conversation, but the problem is that once we've gotten information from the registrar that says this is the underlying registrant, or not, you know, the registrant's the privacy service or whatever, then we go back and we tell the complainant they have to amend their complaint or not, or the complaint is fine. And so if something filters in later, so if the privacy or proxy service is revealed or released after that lock and after the provider is notified, the reason it's important to say the provider is under no obligation to require the complainant to amend is because now I have to start completely over. And now my staff has to go back over and redo another deficiency check. In the meantime, we may have already started to commence the case and serve the parties and prepare the letters and everything else. And then we have to tell the complainant it's got to, oh, yeah, sorry, you know, we told you 2 days ago or yesterday that your complaint was fine. Guess what? It's not. And you're going to have those raving complainants lawyers because now they got to bill their client a third time to go back and fix the complaint that originally was declared correct based on the first information from the registrar. It doesn't provide any finality. I mean, we don't know if a privacy proxy relationship is revealed or released after the lock. I mean, how far down the road does the complainant have to go back and amend its complaint? And that just, there's no finality. We never, never, ever know then that we can finally commence the case and we know who the respondent is. If we say once the lock is applied, we get to proceed, you know, we're going to just proceed with that information, then it's up to the respondent at that point to come back and notify the provider, hey, no, it's not the privacy service, it's me. And so that's really why I think at that point, once the lock is applied and the registrar's told the provider who the underlying registrant is, at that point the burden needs to be put on the respondent to correct that information and not to require the provider and the complainant to have to go back and do yet a third iteration of the complaint and the deficiency check.
Yeah, it's Alan. I have a question first and then maybe a comment. I know this is a discussion we had before because I remember I raised it, but I don't remember the outcome. And that is, to what extent are we trying to write recommendations for a world where there is currently no accreditation of privacy proxy services and the registrar cannot know for sure in many cases whether it is a privacy proxy service or the end registrant? I know we discussed the fact that any privacy proxy accreditation will have to go through a PDP and it's not likely to happen very quickly. So are we trying to write rules for before and after, just before, on the assumption that the accreditation PDP would have to revise some UDRP parts if it's applicable? I want want some clarity as to understand what world are we writing this recommendation for.
Well, and maybe that's a question for Marika. I'm coming at it from the what's happening here and now, because for the reasons you just stated, we don't know when or if we're actually going to end up with a registrar accreditation policy or a process. A private service accreditation process. And we currently have these problems in the UDRP today. I mean, theoretically, you know, if we're looking at opening the UDRP up for revisions in 18 months anyway, I mean, you could make that same argument. Why are we even here? Why don't we just, you know, pretend like we're making recommendations for that process? So in my head, we're trying to fix problems that exist today. And if we can solve some of those problems later with privacy proxy accreditation or changes to the UDRP or other things that are possibly coming down the road, then great and fantastic, and we can, you know, maybe we are able to solve other problems at that time. But I guess I prefer to solve the problems we have today, and that we don't have definite and firm conviction that we're actually going to, you know, we don't know when we're going to get the problems addressed using these other mechanisms.
Okay.
That's sort of my interpretation, but I could be completely wrong on that.
No, I think that's a reasonable way to proceed. You know, to try to make rules for what will happen when there is accreditation, I mean, I can hypothesize that there will be a flag in the WHOIS saying this is a privacy or a proxy provider, and therefore the registrar will know how to proceed and the dispute provider will know how to proceed. But I don't know for sure that's going to happen, so I don't think we can work on it. Volker, I now have some specific questions, but Volker had his hand up. Go ahead.
Yes. Just to clarify, of course, that the reveal that I had in mind would have a certain deadline. So basically, when the registrar informs WIPO that the process would not immediately go on with the check and informing of the complainant that everything is all right, but if we, for example, allowed a 48-hour deadline, which would, of course, require changing some of the deadlines in the UDRP, within that time no reveal happened, then that would be legitimate, and then WIPO would just inform the complainant that the complaint would have to be amended. And the second point I wanted to raise is that even though we have had cases where we immediately lifted our own privacy service when we received the notice and informed WIPO of the identity of the real registrant, WIPO and NAF in this case, so we had both cases, we found that in the end there were cases where the header of the complaint still listed our privacy service as the respondent. And I think that's a problem, especially if you have cases where there's multiple domain names in a complaint and the privacy proxy reveals that there's multiple respondents under that, or domain owners under that, and the complaint still proceeds as one because the complainant assumes that it is one case because the privacy service is in the WHOIS. I think that's a real problem. As the UDRP allows combining cases into one with multiple domain names, this becomes a problem if the WHOIS privacy is not able to be revealed, because then you would have cases where multiple respondents would be required to respond.
Thank you. Christine?
Yeah, this is Christine from NAF. So as long as there's not two separate deadline periods, I guess I don't disagree with Volker's first point then. I mean, if the group consensus is it's preferable to give extra time in the deficiency, you know, in that initial lock request period, so rather than, I think we said it would be one business day, you know, making it 48 hours or two business days or whatever we decide, to give the registrar time. I mean, we do have to think about the impact on the UDRP and the provider's responsibility there. But, I mean, if that's really the way to solve the proxy service, I don't really object to that. My problem is we can't have two deadlines. We can't say, well, you're supposed to lock within one business day, but you can come back up to 48 hours later and change the information, because that's going to create the situation where, you know, we're going to send the case back to the complainant yet again, and everybody's got to duplicate their work at a pretty high, you know, cost to both the provider and to the complainant. So I think that allowing a second deadline is not practical. But if in fact the group decides that giving the registrar time to track down the privacy or proxy service is an important thing, then I think the best way to do that is to just extend the period and make a recommendation that just says, you know, that the provider has the extra time during the deficiency check. Then, I mean, that's probably just the best way to do that. With respect to the naming of the respondent, if you look up above in the part in red that we already discussed, it says for the purposes of the UDP, the registrant, this is the bottom of, I think, page one, for the purposes of the UDRP, the registrant listed in the WHO is record at the time of the lock will be recorded as the respondent. And that's how NAF currently does their process. So even if a registrar comes back and says, hey, here's my client's information, if the information isn't changed in the WHO is, then we're still proceeding against the party named in the WHO is. So we'll serve whoever you tell us, you know, in your email to us. We'll serve them and we'll send them all the documents. But the caption case will be against whoever's listed in the WHO is. So that's why that is in there as part of the commentary. And then from there, it's up to the registrant to let us know if it's really not the WHO is service or whatever. So I just wanted to point that out. And that's why it says that I included that language in that original section, I guess.
Just to comment on that, I mean, I handled the UDOP cases for a long time myself in our office, so I know how we deal with it. And in that case, the first thing we do when we receive a notice and we see that the WHO is privacy domain name, we deactivate a certain flag, and then the original domain, the original information is in the WHO is. And at that, after that, we apply the lock and inform WIPO. So at that point, when we inform WIPO about the other providers about who is in the WHO is, then the WHO is has already changed. And we still have seen cases where after that, the process wasn't amended.
Is that recently, Volker, or are you talking a few years ago?
We only implemented our WHO is privacy service 1.5 years ago, so it's quite recently, yes.
Okay. Well, if you ever see that situation, contact me directly. Because we changed our rules a couple years ago, so we should be listing in the WHO in the complaint. The complainant is supposed to list whoever's listed in the WHO is.
Okay. I'll check that.
Okay, and I thank you, Olga. I put myself in the queue. With regard to the two deadlines for an in-house privacy proxy service, and as Volker just described, that's fine to have one deadline, but I think we need two deadlines, at least two different time periods. I won't say deadline in the overall policy, because we are putting a requirement on the registrar not to notify the registrant until it's locked, and until therefore for a privacy proxy service that is not in-house, the sequence has to be it's locked, and then you notify the registrant, which implicitly means if it's a privacy proxy service, they may come back, and I guess we need to require them to come back in a certain time so the registrar can take whatever action they need. So there really needs to be two deadlines in the process to handle the case of a non-in-house privacy service. As far as I understand, or proxy service, rather.
Alan, this is Marika. The problem with that is that as there is no accreditation program, it's not possible for the registrar to determine whether someone that's requesting the changes is a legitimate service or not. I think we've already went back and forth on this item, and you're coming back to Christine's point on, you know, we're dealing with the issues we can deal with now. Of course, nothing prevents a working group to, you know, pass on any recommendations or suggestions to the effort that will deal with the privacy and proxy accreditation. But I think what I, you know, have starting to write the initial report, what I noted down there is basically saying, well, any changes would need to be made within that time frame. And indeed, you're right, something that will need to be discussed, and I think we've touched upon it before as well, is that, you know, does contacting the privacy proxy service, does that does it equal contacting the registrant? And should an exception be written into that, noting that, if it concerns a proxy privacy service, that's not considered as communication, or that communication is allowed. But I'm not really sure how we can do two time frames if we cannot assess who's eligible for that second time frame at this point in time.
No, I wasn't suggesting that, and I was talking about today's world, not a future world. What I was saying is we know that there are privacy proxy services out there which are not in-house. And if we want to be able to allow a reasonable amount of time for that privacy proxy service, should it exist, to reveal the real registrant and have the real registrant be the one the case is against, then we have to allow some time after the formal deadline, after the lock. So maybe the whole thing says if you are going to reveal, it has to be, within 2 days, and the registrar knows he better lock faster than that to give the registrar a window to try to find out if there's underlying data or not. I'm just saying we have to be cognizant of the fact that they're not allowed to notify the registrant of record until after the lock, and that's the window in which a reveal can be done if it's not in-house. So we simply have to make sure the time frames allow for that sequence. And that's what I was trying to imply. You're right, there may not be two deadlines in it, but the sequence that we're mandating must allow for that to happen. Otherwise, we'll put the registrar again in a catch-22 situation where they cannot meet all of the obligations and at the same time give registrants a fair opportunity to reveal the underlying registrant. I'll be quiet now. We have Volker and then Matt.
What I was proposing mainly concerns such animals as accredited who is privacy proxy providers once they ever come into existence, or affiliated ones. I'm not sure if we should extend that same privilege to unaccredited or other privacy proxy services in the wild, because that would, in my opinion, create some uncertainty. In that case, where we would have accredited proxy privacy accreditation services, then we would immediately lock the domain name as we do currently when we receive the complaint, and then the privacy service would be informed, and they would have a two-day window in which they would have to inform both the privacy the UDP service provider and the registrar, and at that point, in that time window, let it be 48 hours or something else, the service could be lifted again, the lock could be lifted again with the agreement of the provider, and only after the 48-hour second window has passed, the lock becomes more permanent and no further changes can happen. I would like to illustrate that with another example, which was a problem recently in a UDAP case we had with WIPO, where we had a privacy service with which was one of our resellers, and they forwarded everything that they had. They chose not to reveal because they didn't receive it in time, and they forwarded everything they received from WIPO concerning the complaint to the actual registrant. The actual registrant would have been very happy to transfer the domain name, but he tried to agree in the suspension period that they wanted to transfer, but we couldn't accept that agreement because we weren't able to verify that they were the registrant, and the reseller was a bit quiet on the quiet side.
When you say transfer, do you mean put their own name in who is, or transfer to the complainant?
Transferred to the complainant. The complainant had requested a suspension of the process, and the original registrant had agreed to that transfer. So we would have been able to transfer the domain name right away, and just because we didn't see the information of the complainant, we weren't able to reveal that because we didn't have that information. We weren't able to confirm that is indeed the actual registrant, the respondent in this case, and has the authority to transfer. So in this case, it would have been helpful if the WHO's privacy service had been able to lift that, and then in that case, we would have been able to transfer the domain name in the suspension period, which was a problem.
Thank you. Matt?
Hey, so one specific response to a couple of comments that Volker's made. I wonder if it would be useful if you either email David Rich Turner on the group or offline and then circulate his response about what the specific case numbers are to see if he has any recommendations for the current draft proposal that might address those specific situations that have arisen. He may be able to dig through their files and sort of track it and give you a really specific answer for those. The other more general comment, following up on Alan's suggestion that there are non-affiliated privacy proxy services right now and that our rule should take them into account. I think we have to note that they exist, although I don't think we have to necessarily pick a rule that is equally convenient for those as it is for in-house privacy proxy services. If the rule ends up de facto favoring one or the other, that's kind of not our problem. So I don't think it's – I agree with you that we shouldn't ignore them, but I don't think we need to make a rule that has the side effect of maybe making life slightly less convenient for them than for in-house privacy proxy services.
Yeah. Thank you, Matt. My only comment is I wasn't suggesting we make it convenient for them, just that we set the deadlines for the registrar that allow – I mean, we know there exist arm's-length privacy proxy services, and they do seem to be involved in UDRPs. So the time frame should make it possible for the real respondent, the real registrant, to be named. So we shouldn't set an impossible deadline of you must let us know within 4 microseconds after we tell you, otherwise it's too late. I'm not necessarily saying we have to make it exceedingly convenient for them, just possible. Or at least that's what I was suggesting. All right, how do we go forward on this? Do we need to change any of these words at this point? And if so, who's willing to try to draft them? Marika?
Yeah, this is Marika. In hearing the discussion, I'm wondering indeed if just moving the window to 2 business days would allow indeed any checking that needs to be done with, you know, privacy proxy services, noting that indeed we would then need to address the fact of the non-communication or factor in that, you know, it's up to the registrar then to determine, or basically just say, okay, we are not going to say anything about that and basically recommend that this is an issue that is considered as part of the accreditation program and just basically now say, well, within 1 or 2 days it needs to be locked and no communication with the registrant, and basically leave it at that. I don't know. I'm not really sure what the answer is, but I'm seeing that we still have an issue here. And
let me ask a question to Volker or any other registrants, if there are on the call, registrars on the call. Do you have provisions in your agreement saying if you are making this registering on behalf of someone else, and if a UDRP is filed, then the following rules apply? You have certain amount of time to reveal or things like that. Are there any provisions in your registration agreement that address the kind of situation we're talking about?
We have general rules about registrations in the name of a third party or for a third party, but nothing specifically concerning UDRP.
Is it reasonable to assume that once we put in reasonable limits, you might change your registration agreement to then set shorter but also viable limits on the registrant? Because that would give, I'm not sure we can mandate that or want to mandate that registrars do that, but that would give the provider some level of assurance that once the window has closed, it is indeed closed.
Well, we would do that, and I think we could also do that as part of policy that every registrar must include certain language in there.
Okay.
I can have come forward with a lot of requested changes to the agreements.
Okay.
For example, resellers certain document.
Yeah. I mean, that may give us the tools to provide a short but reasonable deadline, and at the same time be, you know, I'm not sure it's being fair to the providers, but giving the providers a, you know, a way to allow them to manage manage their business and exist.
Alan Dissenberg, so can you just repeat what you would like then to see?
Well, the suggestion is that if we say, you know, that the lock and any reveal must be done within 2 business days, that gives the registrar the ability to put in their, and maybe we require it, but it gives them the ability to put in their registration agreement that if you are registering on behalf of someone else, if a UDRP is filed or if some sort of proceeding is filed, then you have, you know, 24 hours or something like that in which to reveal who the underlying respondent should be, or you will be respondent. So I'm not sure I'll leave it up to the registrars to say whether we really want to require it or simply give them a window in which they could put such a requirement in if they choose.
This is Rick, but it still doesn't answer the question on the communication with the registrant. I guess it's something where we can build in an exception, saying unless it concerns your communication in relation to reveal of a privacy proxy service.
No, I don't think so. I think we need to write the rule such that they cannot communicate until a lock is put in, but in under the deadline that they have to respond to the provider, under the 48 hours, the registrar is still allowed to enact changes
to
affect the reveal. Sorry, I'm just trying to formulate the wording here, but I think it's a, you know, we can provide, they have to lock it from the point of view of the registrant making changes unilaterally, but we can allow the reveal to be done even though the lock is normally there. And, you know, Volker was talking about, you know, 2 levels of lock, a really hard lock and a softer lock, and I think that's what we're talking about.
Okay, I think I understand you, so I can try to write that into the recommendations.
Yeah. Okay, let's keep going. Where Volker?
Yeah, just one comment. Our current practice is that when we have a domain name where it's plainly visible that it's a Whois Privacy Service, our usual answer is not this is the registrant when we answer to the provider, but the registrant in this case is a Whois Privacy Provider, this is his data, but there may be an underlying registrant which we have no knowledge about. And if that's the answer, and if that's what happens, and the privacy proxy provider is an accredited entity once the accreditation process comes into play, then I think such a two-fold lock might be a good idea.
Yeah.
That would also be a very good idea to make it more attractive to companies that are not affiliated with the registrar to become accredited with ICANN once the accreditation program is in place, just as an idea.
Yeah, I think once the accreditation program is in place, which we're not trying to work to right now, I think it is reasonable to say that, you know, the registrar and the provider can assume that whoever's the registrant of record and who is, if it's not flagged as a proxy provider, then, because privacy providers, the real registrant is named, just the contact information is masked. But presumably it's a pass through. So it's only the proxy providers we're talking about, where according to the definition in the AOC review, Whois review, it's only proxy that we're worried about. Privacy, there's no question about who the registrant of record is. Sorry, I've lost my train of thought, but I think once we have accreditation, the world becomes a lot simpler, and we can make dogmatic rules that if you're not accredited, you're not a proxy provider, you take responsibility for any domains you register. Okay, Matt, you have your hand up. Sorry, I didn't notice.
So
So I think the problem with having any sort of recognition of a two-tier system now prior to implementation of an accreditation service is that if I am a squatter who owns a bunch of domain names, I put something in my WIS information that says, you know, I am Privacy Service X, and I register all my domain names as Privacy Service X, and I'm treated as a privacy service where, in fact, all I'm going to do is whenever a UDRP complaint is filed, I will simply use the window of time provided by this extra two-stage process to pick some random contact information in an inconvenient jurisdiction instead of providing my actual contact information. So I'm not sure that tagging on the face of the WHOIS record that there's a privacy service involved is necessarily a workaround until, at least not in the universe we're currently in.
No, I don't think anyone was suggesting that we have that kind of flag now. Maybe if I did, I didn't mean that. All I was suggesting is that we set a time frame which allows, you know, in a world without time machines, for the registrar to notify the registrant, and if it is a legitimate privacy proxy service, and I don't know right now how a registrar decides if it's legitimate or someone lying and saying they're a proxy service. I'd be curious about how registrars do make that decision today, but I can't worry about it because it's not something we can legislate. So I was just looking to make sure that we have a viable time frame that covers the situation. I mean, you know, for instance, in the case of Volker, knowing that one of his resellers does operate a privacy service, that allows the things to be done in the right sequence. Marika.
Yeah, this is Rick. To comment as well on what Matt was saying, I think indeed the way I envision it of writing it would be as well that the registrar may, in those cases where he or she feels that they're working with a legitimate privacy proxy service, indeed first put the lock and contact them. And I think as Volker indicated that they would only do that in those cases where they, you know, are sure that they're working with a legitimate service. And I understood them saying as well that it wouldn't happen if indeed it just happens to have proxy or privacy in the registrar name. But I guess, indeed, you know, of course, it may not apply to everyone, but I think, again, those issues are only going to be solved, hopefully, as part of the accreditation program, which could bring some more clarity and certain requirements in place.
Okay. Let's assume you understand the situation. If we want to tear apart the next draft, we can, but hopefully we won't need to. Okay. No more hands. Let's go on then.
Just to note, I did add one footnote that you see at the bottom of page 2, which I'm not really sure is something we can actually require, but there was discussion as well that, of course, when there is a reveal, it should only include data that's actually held on record by the privacy proxy provider and not other data that comes in later at play. But again, I'm not really sure if that's something we can enforce at this point in time, as we don't have any accreditation. So maybe this is just something to mention or a recommendation for the next efforts taking place in that area. I think then the next item, because I think we addressed the comments that Volker made and some of the other items in relation to recommendation 3, although I see Volker's hand raised, so maybe he wants to go first.
Go ahead, Volker.
Yes, just as an aside, I think we can require them to reveal only the data of the registrant that they have on record, and that is because ICANN has become relatively fond of doing audits, so I'm assuming that the privacy providers will also be regularly audited, and in that case it can be reviewed.
Yeah, right, so only when indeed the program is in place, that's what I meant, but not currently.
Well, I mean, registrars could put such a rule in their registration agreement. There's no way to verify it.
Right.
I mean, when things are accredited, there's a whole bunch of interesting questions open up. Is the privacy proxy service data going to be subject to escrow?
can that escrow data be revealed in some circumstances without the privacy proxy service doing something? All sorts of good questions come up. Not clear that there are anything we can deal with today, though. We are approaching the hour. Marika, I don't think we really can start on the next item at this point. Is there anything else we need to do? I'm presuming we'll meet next week. McKaylee cannot be on the call. At this point, I believe I will be. If my schedule needs to change, then I'll send out an email and we'll either find a temporary alternative chair or we'll cancel the meeting. But other than that, let's presume there is a meeting next week.
Yeah, and this is Rick. If I can just encourage everyone to review as well the rest of the recommendations and send any suggested edits or changes to the mailing list so we can really try to get to a stage where we have everything on the table that needs to be discussed and hopefully come to closure and not having to go back and forth between some of these items. So if I can just encourage everyone to do that,
so
that would be
you,
really
you encourage us to do the review more than a half hour before the meeting.
Exactly.
I'll try. As usual, no guarantees. Thank you all for an interesting call. I think we didn't get very far, but I think we have a much better understanding of the problem for this particular recommendation than we did at the beginning. So thanks for your participation. From a call that looks like we weren't going to have any people on, we ended up with pretty good attendance and discussion. Thank you all.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks,
Thank
Alan.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for participating in today's conference call. You may now disconnect. Mm-hmm.